So the point in the "you are not Google" is not an insult, I don't think, and it's not something that you should feel down about, but I think it's meant to serve as a reminder of the context is very important.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Skylar Nesham. Skylar is the VP of Engineering at Dawalla. They're a fast-growth fintech scale-up. They've raised over $50 million to connect enterprises to the U.S. banking system. The Dawalla team has built one of the most disruptive products out there in the enterprise fintech space, and they've done it all from Des Moines, Iowa. In this episode, we talk about how to transition to a microservices architecture, how to incorporate customer feedback into our product vision, and why it's actually a good thing that we're not Google. I really loved the concrete conversation about transitioning to a microservice architecture. That's something that's on the roadmap for lots of startups, but there aren't a lot of hard-won lessons learned out there. And now, here's my conversation with Skylar Nesham. Skylar Nesham, thank you for joining us today on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks. It's an honor to be here.
What is the most important inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
So I was thinking about this, and I have a little bit of a different angle on this, I think. For me, I think to the time when I met my partner, actually, because there's this thing where you meet someone and you form a connection with them, and they sort of change your perspective on a number of things. And maybe they're a balance or a counterexample to who you are. And they have the ability to really get to know you and push you and drive you. And so when I met Jessica, I was in college and I was doing okay in college. But I think, you know, as we got to know each other and talk, I think she really pushed me. I'm like, you don't challenge yourself. You don't work hard enough. Like, you're getting a B when you could easily get an A. You're sloughing off on your studying a little bit, you know, and she sort of, like, not in straight up words, but in non-specific words, sort of set the tone of, like, this is the type of person that I want to partner with. And that relationship changed things for me and pushed me in new ways. And I think a lot of that stuff I have brought into my career, and it has very much influenced the types of tasks that I've taken on and the types of challenges I've placed for myself. And that partnership, I think, was really important.
That's awesome. So you kind of change your trajectory is what you aspire to do in the work. I know it's not a romantic partnership, but I think we kind of have partnerships with our teams. How do you think you've been able to take that kind of push and challenge and trajectory into running your teams?
When it comes to building software, this is talked about a lot, but there is sort of this thing we talked about that's like the actual process of writing codes and code and building systems and deploying things. And we spend a lot of time talking about that stuff. Another very important piece of this is building relationships and figuring out how we work together to best solve problems. And when you think about maybe a romantic relationship or a relationship with a partner, it's not the exact same way that you apply it at work, obviously. But there are certain traits of that you do bring into your work life. You know, another aspect of this that is not work related, but definitely influences the way that I talk to people and the way I work through problems is some of my experiences with parenting and having young kids and talking to them and working through things with them. So these experiences outside of work give me an opportunity to work through conflict and think about how do we resolve conflict internally? How do we communicate conflict? How do we raise conflict? And ultimately, getting through those things gives us an opportunity to build trust so that we can better work together going forward.
You're coming up on 7 years at Dawalla. So you've been there since Series B, lots of change, lots of growth. I would love to hear the story of, I know you went through the process of splitting your application out into multiple services so that you could better support multiple teams. Can you kind of talk us through, like, when did you realize you had to do that and how did that project go?
I think this is a journey that a lot of companies go through. You have an application and you're focused on iterating on that application or that set of that technology stack. And you're moving very quickly. So you're keeping it small, you're keeping it tight, you're trying to reduce complexity. And at some point, as your business becomes successful, you start to find a market fit and you realize the different ways that you need to grow and build your company. And you might see that you need to expand teams. Maybe you've been focused on one team and it's four or five people and they're all masters of this technology stack and they're all kind of working together and collaborating on it. But you might see that, hey, in order to actually make progress on our company's mission and help our customers, we've got to split what we're trying to do into multiple goals. And we actually need to run multiple things at once. We've got to grow our team. And as you look at that, for us, one of the things that I think we realized is that it's not just about adding more engineers or splitting up the way that we do work into multiple threads or parallel tracks. The architecture of the applications and the way that we deploy our applications also needs to evolve to support this. So at Dwolla, when we started to realize that, we started looking at how do we take, you know, something that maybe mostly one technology stack and think about how we can split that up so that multiple teams can work on it simultaneously. And, you know, at that time, we were really looking at a microservices architecture where we could have services that were completely their own stack and were responsible for their own problem domain so that we had the ability to work on multiple things at once and deploy them with tight interfaces between these things so that we would trust if we deploy service A, it's not going to break service B. We had to have a tight interface there. But as long as we kept those contracts and tight interfaces and tried to keep those technology stacks separate, we're able to work on and evolve service A and service B sort of simultaneously.
On an abstract level, that sounds awesome. Like, let's deploy. I think that story seems pretty succinct and I hear it a lot, but I'd love to hear, you know, you actually did it. You went through this process. You thought through what's the right domains, what are the right services? What are some things that you wish you could tell past Skylar? That you could avoid some missteps and, you know, some rework.
So I mentioned tight interfaces, and that is a abstract concept and one that's hard to attain. But if there's a contract between service A and service B, that contract needs to be maintained. And the power in maintaining that contract means that you can ultimately build trust and relationship between those two things. So past Skylar and past engineering teams would have really liked to hone in on that more quickly, that if there is a contract between two services, we need to in some way deeply consider how we prevent breaking that relationship.
And were most of those contracts like APIs? Is that kind of what that contract looked like?
Yeah. API contracts. Yeah, microservices. So it's systems talking to other systems. And absolutely, you know, that's kind of like the innards of what's going on in the application or in our platform stack. But that same thing applies back to our customers. And we've done, I think, a really good job there. That's maybe something that we worked through that maybe wasn't as intentional as it happened. But internally, we discovered a lot about how to run a service-oriented or a microservice architecture. And that influenced a lot of the ways that we approach the API that we provide to our customers. And we really do everything in our power to prevent breaking changes within that API. In fact, I'm not aware of anything that we've ever done that would be considered a breaking change to our API that would cause some sort of massive reversioning or massive rewrite for our customers. It's a challenge.
And internal, it sounds like maybe you didn't have that kind of discipline early on, or you weighted that relatively lower in importance. And now you kind of learned that having really strict API guarantees is important internally. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, we definitely learned that lesson. I think a counter example to this that I'm thinking about now is also to sort of like have the knowledge that you're going to make a few mistakes as you try to expand and do this, and that's okay. If you approach it from the aspect that we are going to make mistakes, we're going to do things wrong. If you remove that constraint from yourself, like to say, hey, we're trying to evolve this. If you remove the constraint of like, we can't make a mistake and say, we plan to make a mistake, then what things would your team do or would the technology need to do to support that kind of evolution?
So making it resilient to mistakes.
then I think that opens up the types of questions that you want to ask. So how could we be resilient to this type of change? Or how could we make us take a small step so that we can evaluate if this is going to cause problems, things like that. But that was another lesson learned in the process of evolving this architecture, would be taking very small steps and not trying to take big bang or holistic approaches to problems, but what is the first step we can take in an iteration or half an iteration or in a day that allows us to evaluate this approach and gain feedback.
And whenever you were making those, you had your existing teams, you're splitting things out. Did these team split come first, or did the service split come first? Did you split a team and say, go split this thing out, or did you split the thing out and then the team followed?
We focused on the architecture first, and then that allowed us to later split out teams that could work on those things. I think that you could do it either way. The other approach that we took that was pretty successful is we had a part of our application that would be maybe more monolithic. And instead of sitting down and saying, all right, we need to break this whole thing up, and it's a large project in order to do that, we instead tried to be opportunistic, looking at the roadmap for our product and knowing the things that we needed to do and thinking about how we could utilize our product roadmap as opportunities to evaluate ways to evolve our architecture kind of at the same time. And so that allowed us to sort of chip away at maybe some of that core thing that was originally built and start to break it out as our teams evolve for need. The other side effect of that was that we didn't have to work on things that weren't necessary for our business to evolve. We were able to prioritize the right things that enabled the business to evolve instead of taking, so we managed, what I'm trying to say is that we took both a business and a technology focus at the same time, instead of taking just a technology view of it or just a business view of it. Those two things sort of lived together as we evolved the product.
Do you remember any of the features or enhancements you're working at the time that kind of spurred, are working on this part of the system, so let's split this part of the system out because we're already enhancing it?
Yeah, a big one that those two things kind of evolved side by side was Dwell's original project was very consumer to consumer focused. It allowed business to business transfers of money and things like that, but it was very focused on consumer to consumer. And as we started opening up an API to developers, what we started to hear feedback a lot on is, hey, we like the API. We love the ability to work with this product that you've developed, but it still has a lot of Dwell's name to it when we do it. So when we have to accept an OAuth flow, Dwell's name is part of that. When we go to transfer money, sometimes Dwell's name is part of that. And we would like the ability to do this sort of in a way that we had more control over our user's experience. And some people would maybe refer to it as like a white label way. And so we started thinking about, all right, what's the next application of our API or our platform for moving money? And what would it look like to run that in an experience where it's more controlled by our customers and less controlled and less part of our name? So that was the business thing. At the same time, we had the technology thing of that original API sort of being part of maybe a core or a legacy part of the product. Those two things paired together ended up in this evolution of our API, where we now offer a white label API for money movement. That stack is itself a separate microservice that evolved out of that thing. So it was both a business, conscious business decision to think about a new vertical and at the same time applying new technology to that new vertical.
That's a great example. Thanks for sharing that. So you were going to build a white label and instead of building it within the or white label API, instead of building with the existing monolith, use as an opportunity to build a new service that serve that new use case. So that's a great example.
Right. And there were a bunch of other fringe things that we needed back from that core product. And so as we built out the new API and realized that we needed access to those features, we built services that would give us access to those features in the core product instead of other ways that you might integrate with the thing. So that kind of built upon itself of evolving the architecture.
So I've just been asking you for some advice that has a lot of context around it. I'm curious to go meta on that. How do you find advice? Because, you know, we're gonna build microservice. We're gonna go service oriented architectures. It's really nice in the abstract, but how do you look for advice as a leader that has the appropriate context?
I was actually just thinking a lot about this myself. I think, you know, in this time that we are in now, there's so much information out there. You know, you can find a number of articles online, a number of blogs, a number of technology leaders that will give you different kinds of input and different ideas on how you might build systems or how you might evolve architecture. And to your point, context is very important there, because the context of what strategy you employ on a 5-person team in a consumer-focused product is perhaps a lot different than the context you would need in a 10,000 or 1,000 person development team in a business focused context. Those are two very different problems, and a lot of the foundation that we start upon is similar, but the approaches that we take are very context dependent. So a good starting point for me is, who are other leaders that are in businesses like myself? And in a technology company, if you've received venture funding or you have other partner companies that you work with, one thing that has been successful for me is to look for opportunities to find partnerships or mentors within your network. If you can connect with those folks and they maybe have a similar context to you, they can be a great sounding board for advice on an approach that you're considering. So that's one strategy that I've used that's pretty successful.
So finding more long-lived relationships with folks that might be in your industry that are already in your network.
Yeah. One thing that I've heard like recently is like, I think I saw an article about this recently, and the title might even been this of like, you're not Google.
Yeah.
Right. So you'll see these things that Google does, and engineers are always fascinated. I myself definitely have a background in engineering, and I am also fascinated by super challenging problems at a very large scale. And those are a lot of the types of things that Google or other large technology companies have to solve. And so the point in the you are not Google is not an insult, I don't think, and it's not something that you should feel down about. But I think it's meant to serve as a reminder of the context is very important.
I read the white paper on, I think it's called Zanzibar. They're like, you know, globally distributed authentication system that takes like trillions of requests per second, has to respond in 10 MS. It's like, that is really cool. But that is not the problem that we have with authentication at all. And if we go and try to build that, we are wasting a lot of time.
Yeah.
I think that same pattern applies for hiring, applies for teams, microservices.
Yeah. In the early days of building a company or getting started, and even as you keep expanding, I think it's important to keep in mind, what are core competencies that you want to focus on? And sometimes your team can surprise you what core competencies are actually really important that are differentiators for you that may be directly related to your business model or just supporting of your business model. But there are other times where you might be working on a problem and your team may be giving you this feedback or this underlying tone that it's sometimes a challenge to pick up on is like, hey, Skylar, this doesn't feel like a core competency for us. And to me as a leader, that's a signal like, hey, can we start looking on how we might buy this product or how we might partner to get this product instead of it being something that we do ourselves?
Have you made one of those decisions recently where you decided that actually buy or partner was a better choice than developing that core competency?
So in this case, I would actually use working with Woven as an example. When we go to find candidates for engineering positions, we can spend a lot of time trying to dig in on the data about the candidates and trying to find the right technical assessment for candidates and things like that. With Woven, we saw an opportunity of that is a core competency for your team. And it's something that I think your team is doing very well, Wes. And
thank you.
When I first chatted with you, I didn't actually mean for this to evolve into a sales pitch, but here we are. So I saw that as a core competency and something that I think that your team sort of gets and they're evolving. And I saw that as an opportunity to partner with someone to outsource that capability for our team. So it allows, is it something that we could solve? I think so. I think we have some smart people. But I also recognized on the other side, you've got a bunch of great smart people on your staff as well. And I saw an opportunity to work with you. And there's an example right there of partnering on something that might not be a core competency, so you can focus back on your core product.
Makes sense. I promise I wasn't fishing for that, but I appreciate the example. I think there's lots of areas where, you know, scaling an engineering team, there are so many areas to focus. I've seen, you know, performance management tools. Could you build the best performance management system from scratch? Probably. You got smart engineers, you could do it. The best hiring system, the monitoring system. I saw a tweet from a medium-sized startup that they built their own Columnar data store for their monitoring system. It's like, that is really cool engineering, but it is not obvious to me that that is the best use of that particular team's time. I think which is challenging because good engineering teams really like building stuff. How we help people draw that line. Is there any heuristics on like what should be a core competency versus what shouldn't be a core competency for you?
I think that you have to keep your business model in mind and knowing who your customer is and keeping contact with that customer is probably the best way, in my opinion, one of the best ways to keep in contact with what the core product needs to be. As long as you have that view or that feedback mechanism in place, I think you will naturally gravitate towards the right things that are core competencies for you. Because you're constantly getting customer feedback and hearing what they need and hearing how your product needs to evolve, that feedback will be a very strong voice in your organization. And you won't be able to ignore that feedback or that advice to go work on exciting problem like you're building your own Columnar data store.
How have you been able to keep that feedback loop? One challenge is, you know, engineers need focus box of time to be successful. Customer just tickets going all the time is interrupty. Are there any processes that you've been able to balance that interrupt driven versus like direct customer feedback at Dwolla?
One really cool thing that we've been working on is our user experience team that's part of our product organization has actually created a mechanism for customer feedback. So we have a customer feedback program and we've openly invited customers to contact us and reach out if they'd like to be part of that problem. And the team literally has calls with them where they ask them questions about the problems they're facing, interfacing with our product, maybe, or things that their business is facing and how we could expand to support them even further. And so that has been a great mechanism for getting feedback on our product. And that's been something I've been really excited about seeing evolve.
So the UX team is, you know, getting customers enrolled, they're scheduling meetings, and then the engineering team, are they kind of watching recordings or debriefs, or are they actually on those calls sometimes?
It depends. A lot of times we know kind of the topic or what customers want to talk about, and it depends. Sometimes it makes sense for an engineer to be on that call, and sometimes it doesn't. And it actually varies what kind of engineer it makes sense. Sometimes it may make more sense that someone that has front-end experience or a front-end focus. Sometimes it might make more sense from someone who's thinking more about, you know, the API product and its accessibility and how easy it is to call and how easy it is to work with and modify for your purposes. It really varies based call to call, which is, again, I think honing in on what feedback are we seeking and what's important to this particular customer.
I love that you have engineers on those actual calls. That's I think there's no replacement for that human interaction. Like hearing someone's emotion, why they struggle with a problem is maybe, like, at least for me, that is the most motivating thing to go build a solution. I've also, I've been surprised by how much the friction of setting up a conversation can like make those conversations not happening. So having a team that's like making that happen is like, oh, I'll just jump on a conversation. That sounds amazing. Have you seen any decisions that engineering decisions made differently as a result of engineers actually being in those conversations?
Absolutely. Especially when the point of contact can sometimes be, you know, since we are an API driven or an API first company, sometimes that point of contact or that point of feedback is almost engineer to engineer. And so then the feedback, you know, multiplies in terms of the impact that it can have, because not only can I hear what you're saying, but we can talk about it maybe with the exact same terminology or very similar terminology. And then that impacts, I was thinking about making this change to the API. Now that I've heard this feedback, I'm thinking about whether or not that's actually the most efficient or most simplistic way to make the change that I'm considering. And that's been really valuable for our engineers to consider.
I didn't even consider that you might have developers as your users there. So that is an amazingly valuable conversation.
Scaling Software Teams is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we want to help you build a world-class engineering team. That means both getting better at hiring and getting better at management. That's why we have these conversations every week, but we want to take this a step further. For a limited time, we're giving away copies of my favorite engineering management book. The book is called An Elegant Puzzle, Systems of Engineering Management. It's by Will Larson at Stripe, who blogs at Irrational Exuberance, one of the best blogs on the internet. Will does an amazing job joining distributed systems engineering with the ultimate distributed system. Teams of humans, listen to me. If you go to woventeams.com/book and schedule a call with me to talk about your hiring plans, we'll send you a free copy of the book. Again, that's woventeams.com/book for your free copy of An Elegant Puzzle. That's woventeams.com/book.
You've grown a great engineering team at Dwolla in Des Moines, Iowa. Not a city that typically comes to mind immediately when you think about fast-growing fintech companies. Can you talk about the challenges associated with recruiting and hiring in small to mid-markets?
For me, it has been a lot of fun to be part of Dwolla's journey in Des Moines. I know that prior to being at Dwolla, I've been here for about 7 years. I was working in what would more classically be called an enterprise company. And it was a great opportunity. I learned a lot about building software, about delivering software, about the impact that software can have. But when it came time for me to start thinking about my career and where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do, I was really looking for a place that I could make an impact. And at that time, I saw Dwolla as an opportunity to join a company early on. Yes, I was taking some risk, but also an opportunity for reward to make an impact. And that was something that was very exciting for me. And so as I think about being a small company or a company that is starting in maybe a small city or a smaller community, a big opportunity that you can provide potential employees or a thing that you can talk to them about or make them aware of is their opportunity to make an impact at your company. And that opportunity is something that there aren't a lot of places that you can find those things, especially in a community like Des Moines. We have a great financial and insurance focused, a bunch of financial and insurance focused businesses in Des Moines that are at a large scale, and they're doing very well. They're great places to work. They're great places to learn, to actually start a career or join and build a career from. The value prop that I think we've tried to highlight at Dwolla is some of those companies they definitely have big problems to solve. Dwolla has big problems to solve as well, but fewer people and fewer and less time to do it with. So what that means is, if you thought about our floor here, and you thought about like problems just laying on the floor, there's a number of problems that I would consider maybe like once a career type problems that you can go to a small company and help solve that would be once in a career type problems in a larger company. And it's really fun for me to present those types of challenges to our team and give them the opportunity to work on them.
I love that. I saw a blog post recently about, you know, how you can recruit in San Francisco, and they're in the kind of the headline was like, just promising impact doesn't work anymore. Everyone's got that. And to me, that was like kind of shocking, because I'm in Indianapolis. So I think to me, promising impact is what most of the people I talk to get excited about. I love that you highlighted impact is a thing that you can offer, and it's differentiated in Des Moines. And maybe that's less so in San Francisco, which would be, that sounds really hard. I'm kind of glad I'm not there sometimes.
I'm not an expert on this, but there's kind of this discussion that's happening about, well, where is the right place to build a company? because the coasts definitely offer you the proximity to VCs and the proximity to great engineers that have worked on problems like this before. But the Midwest and, you know, this area, it also offers opportunity of people who want to work on problems like that, but probably or possibly aren't interested in relocating or moving to those coastal areas. And so there are, I think, companies that could find value in playing into that sort of niche market. And again, I'm not an expert on this or know how to advise when you should or shouldn't apply that strategy, but it's definitely been part of Dwolla's strategy that I think has worked pretty well. The other thing that I've noticed about our team here that makes our team great is when they join the company and they build it, they become part of the mission and they start solving hard problems. Our engineers have kind of tended to stick around and wanted to be a part of our mission and kind of see things through. And anecdotally, again, I don't have data to back this up, but I don't know if that's always the exact same case for people who are joining companies on the coast. You know, anecdotally, I've heard there can tend to be a little bit more jumping around or moving between positions. And I think that might be evidence that it's not just opportunity, like you were saying, is kind of table stakes. Here, opportunity in the Midwest for us, opportunity has been a way to sort of encourage people to stick around for the mission.
Yeah, it's a differentiator in Des Moines, Indianapolis, and maybe it's not. When you think about those folks that have stuck around to see it to the end, how much have you done anything to kind of cultivate that? Is there any practice that you have internally that you think has improved the likelihood that those folks are going to stick around?
I am constantly thinking about the people on my team and the challenges that they're currently working on and what might be the next great challenge for them. And I think as long as you have that in mind and you're trying to constantly present people with new opportunity, it continues to reinforce that the place that you're at is a great place to be.
My guest today has been Skylar Nesham. Skylar, thanks for joining us on Scaling Software Teams.
Thanks, Wes.
Thanks again to Skylar for sharing his experience with us. Here are a few takeaways I had from our chat. Number one, as we scale, we'll probably need to consider a microservices architecture. Skylar said, "It's not just about adding engineers. Our technology needs to evolve to make it possible for our teams to work on multiple tracks at once." This underlies the idea that microservices are a team scaling strategy more than they are a technology scaling strategy. One thing Skylar learned from his transition is that tight interfaces are a key to a successful microservices transition from a monolithic architecture. There needs to be tight contracts between internal service A and internal service B. Otherwise, problems become evident. We need to deeply consider any way that we might break that contract. We need to version our internal APIs just like we might with an external API. Having a really strict API guarantee is very important for our microservices transition. Number two, the best advice is highly contextual. AKA, you're not Google. There are a lot of ideas out there, and some of them are very exciting. They're crazy scale challenges, trillions of transactions a day, those sort of problems. But we aren't Google. A 5-person team is different than a 1,000-person team. There's also B2B versus B2C, SMB versus enterprise, all the acronyms. That context matters. What we should ask ourselves is, who is in a situation similar to me? Who has the same context? Then we can find partnerships with our investor network to find other folks like me, and we can lean on their experience rather than trying to copy Google and a 1,000-person architecture. Number three, our engineers should talk to actual customers. We need to keep our business model in mind, and the best way to do that is to get engineers in front of customers, especially on already scheduled calls that they can just drop in. That allows them to hear how our product needs to evolve, which creates opportunity for innovation. Engineers know what's possible. If they can also know what the customer is experiencing, that opens up lots of lane for innovation. Skylar has a customer feedback program, which actively reaches out to customers to see if they want to help craft a solution. This reduces the friction
between an engineer wanting to speak to a customer and being immediately on a call with a customer who's excited to talk. Thanks again to Skylar for coming on the show. Now I want to hear from you. Please leave us a review on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. This will help others find our community. Until next week, keep on scaling.